The AutJet Business Show is your gateway to expert business advice and real-world success stories. Each week, a different leader in the business world will share their tips, insights, and lessons, offering you practical advice to navigate your entrepreneurial journey. Whether you have a business idea or are just starting out or looking to elevate your existing business, the AutJet Business Show provides mentoring, inspiration, and invaluable networking opportunities to help turn your vision into reality. Ensure you get these transformative conversations live on Thursdays at 6 p.m. or find the podcast at highfm.com. Let's build your business empire together.
Welcome. You're listening to the AutJet Business Show. I'm David Zeidel, and it's Thursday again. Every time it feels like it's Thursday, like the next day. Today we've got a special guest with us, Ryan Noach. He's the CEO of D&I Group, but you must probably know him better as the CEO or the previous CEO of Discovery Health. And I'm going to introduce Ryan formally just now, but welcome, Ryan.
Thank you so much, Dave. Good to be here.
Great. And each week we start off just with a basic little story, and tonight's story is around J.K. Rowling. She's the author of Harry Potter. And the story with her is about perseverance and maybe innovation. She was unemployed. She went to a coffee shop, started writing the book. And in fact, a friend showed me a photo recently of the little coffee shop that she sat in and was overlooking actually a cemetery. And a lot of the characters came from what she was seeing there. And she just stuck with it. Being unemployed, she was actually on care, not getting money. She was getting some extra money. And when she wanted to publish her book, she was rejected by 12 different publishers. And then finally, Bloomsbury finally agreed to publish Harry Potter. And as they say, the rest is history. And she's very famous, very wealthy. And it's around having your belief in yourself. And no matter how many times other people reject you, you need to persevere through that and take risks and understand that your journey is your journey and it doesn't follow what other people think necessarily. So that's the short little business lesson.
And you also wouldn't want to be one of the 10 publishers who said no.
Yes. That's the fear, I think, of most publishers. That's a very good point of the one that they let go.
Yeah. Yeah, and the fear of many investors that you say no to the wrong opportunity.
And this is coming from Ryan, who is an investor and knows the feeling so well. And we're going to unpack that exactly. So, Ryan, I'd like to actually launch straight into that. But before we do, I'd like to introduce you formally. So, as I said, Ryan is now the group CEO of D&I Group, and you'll explain to us what that is and what you do. Formerly with Discovery for 17 years, he's a true trailblazer in the South African healthcare business. He steered Discovery through COVID-19, which was an unprecedented time. He was at the forefront of resilience and positive change. He's really a medical doctor and then went into leading things medically related. And he kind of was the face of all those informative videos and all the talking about the data and the numbers related to the pandemic. And I remember listening intently to everything that you had to say because it was unknown to us. And you came across as an expert understanding what was happening, even though it was something unknown to you at the time, but you were looking at the data behind it. In early 2024, Ryan left Discovery Health to become the group CEO at D&I. It's a leading investment company specializing in B2B distribution and technology services. Now, I'm saying that. I have no idea what that means. You'll tell us what it is. As I said earlier on the promo, you also, in your earlier days, you were the CEO of 911 with all the helicopters and all that, and you helped set that up. And an interesting thing is many of the guests that we've had on the show have been authors. But I think maybe it's not. Maybe I think you're the first person who's the subject of a couple of books where you've, in two books where there's a chapter in each one written about you, and the books are Never Waste a Good Crisis and The CEO X Factor. So Ryan, welcome.
Thanks, and that's a particularly generous introduction, embarrassing to be clear, and exaggerated in some respects. And I should hasten to say that particularly in relation to the COVID-19 narrative that you provide, while I had the privilege of presenting much of that deep analytics and data, there were very large, very competent teams who did a huge amount of work and thinking and research in the background, and allowed Discovery to play an incredibly important role for the country and for its members in our response to COVID-19. So I was fortunate that I got to present some of that data, but believe me, it didn't come from me.
So that's one of the business lessons that we've heard again and again, that it's a team. And You've got a face for TV, I've got a face for radio, so hopefully this will be a good team as well. Ryan, just take us back. I know, and people, obviously they can't see you on the radio, but you're strong, you go to gym, you told me you do gym 6 times a week. What is it? Is it the same thing that makes you strong in gym? Is that what makes you strong in business?
I think there's a personality trait. I make sure that I try and exercise 6 times a week, whether it be gym or some kind of cardio exercise. But I do think there's an underlying sense of drive. And, you know, my philosophy is the more you do, the more you get, the more you give, the more comes back to you. And so, right throughout my life and my career, I've tried to contribute continually to my own development, to my own well-being, and to others around me. And I genuinely believe it comes back to you. I guess I know it's we're on Chai FM and it's not necessarily a Jewish principle, but the Hindu principle of karma, I do believe in some respects, and I think what you put out there does come back to you in many ways.
I want to play on that play of words of the karma that comes back to you, because during the pandemic you were calmer than most of us. And the question I want to ask you, and maybe we'll start with this, is what are the secrets to being successful? Is it just that the more that you give, the more that you get? Or is there something more in terms of you've held positions, high positions in all the businesses that you've done? If you had to talk to your younger self, and you had to look at what you had done right. So I'm asking you the question I normally ask at the end of the interview. I'm going to ask you beforehand, what are some of the do's and some of maybe the don't do's in leading a successful business life?
Yeah, and right at the outset, Dave, I should say that success is defined in many different ways. And, I still develop a bit of imposter syndrome at times and feel like I could be much more successful and do much more. So, but in my own way, I've enjoyed every moment of what I've done. And I think the starting point to your question is probably to have a hell of a lot of fun. I think you need to find a convergence of three things, I guess, and I'm making this up as I go. The one is something that you're deeply passionate about, that you really enjoy doing, that you have a lot of fun doing every single day. So I would say find a passion. The second is something that is differentiated, unique. And the third is something that people need and that meets a need of customers. And if you can do good, be good, and do that around a passionate area of your interests, and at the same time people can benefit from it, that's a wonderful convergence. And then I think that builds into a very sustainable, differentiated opportunity. I think it actually all starts with a very clear purpose. And for me, I think it is probably essentially about having a purpose, being completely purpose-driven, and testing everything you do against that purpose, and being true to that purpose in many respects. And that's something that Adrian Gore has done extremely well at Discovery, and something that I try and stick to in my own life. In truth, I think it's a bit of a cliche, but probably the biggest remedy to any difficulty is work rate. It helps to have intellect and emotional maturity and a support structure, and but I think work rate is absolutely critical, and one has to sustain an extremely high work rate, especially at times of great opportunity or great challenge. That's when the work rate really becomes critical. I would say, you know, surround yourself with the best people you can possibly find. And we should unpack that. By the best people, I mean people that are smarter than you, that are more capable than you, that are better and more efficient than you. And surround yourself with those people. I think any good leader at any one time has three successors in their wings. And I think it's a real warning sign for a leader or a business when you have a leader who doesn't have immediate succession. Generally, you know, that spells a situation where a leader is surrounding themselves with people that they can dominate and they can lead through a power leadership style. My own view is surround yourself with people that are stronger than you, and that can, you know, you can inspire them and provide a vision, but that they, you know, they can do so much more than you can on your own. So I think a team is central, and that may be cliched, but it really is a recurring pattern for me. It is about who you surround yourself with. I've managed to expose myself to multiple different fields and careers, which I'm very lucky and I'm very privileged to have been able to do. But when I try and think through what that's about, I think it's about an insatiable appetite to keep learning. You know, if you remain deeply hungry and curious to learn about different fields and different things, I think that it drives you to become a better person and a better leader, and certainly to excel. I'm just spewing out ideas here, and I'm sorry, maybe it's a ramble of ideas, but I suppose linked to all of this, one needs sincere humility. And I keep seeing that the best leaders are truly authentic leaders who are absolutely clear about how they feel, their fears, their vulnerabilities, probably very, very courageous to break through those vulnerabilities, but truly humble. Not words, you know, speaking to humility, but actions that demonstrate absolutely no hubris, that they're willing to change their minds. They're willing to listen to a rational argument, take advice. They're happy to be proven wrong. They accept being looked at as weak. And I think those are actually the good leaders. I think the ones that, you know, well, I can think of some very rich ones who aren't like that. Probably Elon Musk is the first that comes to mind, where there's such complete, sincere self-belief that everybody else, including perhaps the leader of the free world, is wrong. You know, I suppose that's the other extreme. He's far more successful than I could ever wish to be. But in my own leadership mantra, it's certainly, you know, not my approach. Mm. I'm really strongly of that view. I think to complement all of this, part of the reason I did medicine and it's driven a big part of my life, I think one has to be a force for good, a socially responsible actor and leader. And I think you need to keep giving to the world in whatever you do.
Hmm. Can I stop you there and just ask you a question? Because you've gone through a whole list of things, which are just quite amazing. Obviously, having your purpose. But I want to highlight something that you just went through. And you spoke about work rate. Just, are you able to unpack that? What do you mean by work rate, and how do you know if you're hitting the work rate that you should be hitting?
Yeah, I suppose, you know, there's a couple of measures of that. But when I lead a team, what I'd like to see is that the team, when we're faced with an opportunity or a problem, a moment of intensity is needed, that the team and the individuals come together and literally don't switch off the lights until we have been through 100 iterations of solving that or exploring that or optimizing that. And we've convinced ourselves rationally and emotionally that through consensus, it's the right thing to do. And that requires sometimes hundreds of hours of work, much research, and an endless desire to achieve the perfect and outcome from that. And you know, this cigarette box approach of my instinct is this, and this is, I think, how we're going to run it, that's deeply helpful. And finding those people who have those instincts is critical. But then you've got to take those instinctive issues and you've got to, you know, tease them out and do the game theory around each of them and understand each scenario and think of what, you know, the risks are and the potential outcomes of each. And that takes a huge work rate. And something that, you know, I think frustrates some people who work for me, or with me would say I'm a difficult leader at times, is because I keep going round and round to try and get to the bottom of that until one has to then break through.
Right. And I want to ask you around, is it what we normally refer to as root cause analysis, to go and see what the root of an issue is? But if you're just listening to this and you're not sure who we're talking to, it's Dr. Ryan Noach. And now, when you talk about work rate, is that's obviously linked to the purpose. Is work rate just putting in thousands and thousands and thousands of hours? Is it that same concept of you got to do something for 10,000 hours to become an expert, and the quicker you do it, the better you are? Or is there more to that?
Yeah, it's certainly about putting in the hours, and I think that's a given. That goes without saying. But one wants to work smartly as well through those thousands of hours. And I think it's about the quality of the research, the amount of communication between a team, the iterative process of improving a strategy or an outcome. And I think all of that for me is encapsulated in that work rate.
So when do you know when you've put in enough work to launch? Because there's always more to do and you can get into analysis paralysis. When do you feel like, okay, this is ready to launch, or you know what, let's give it up. Let's not put good money after bad and let's find something else.
Yeah, I think the latter decision is the easy one of when to can something. You know, if it reaches a natural conclusion that there's too many risks, it's not going to work. That's an easier one. The when to launch is a harder one. Launch is an interesting word that you chose there just quite fortuitously, because Discovery has a very famous launch cycle and launch event every year. And I can tell you that up to the night before, Adrian is still working on that into the early hours, him and Hilton Kellner, and making changes until the very last minute. So, you know, for them, certainly if you want to be inspired by their leadership, it's until the very last moment. I sometimes tend to call it earlier than that. And, you know, Jaco Marie was an inspiring leader, previous CEO of the Standard Bank Group, and was their chairman and deputy chairman for a while. And he once said, you know, the best leaders make their decisions with just over 50% of the information. So I'm of the view that you need that work rate, and then a leader at a point in time needs to step in, you know, cut the Gordian knot, solve the quandary for the team and say, right, you know, thank you, this has been unbelievable work. We've got to the position we need to, and this is the direction we're taking. So I do think it's a leader's role to call it at the right time.
And often people ask, are leaders born or are they made? So if we go back to your school years, were you a leader at school, or is this something that developed afterwards?
I've always had a propensity to lead. When I look back, I cringe about my early leadership years. And I realize now, perhaps now that all my hair's fallen out, that, you know, there's much more to leadership than just being in charge. There are a set of instincts, but there are a set of learned behaviors that are equally important. Then crafting a style, every leader, I think, must craft their own style. from those instincts and those behaviors that fits naturally with their personality. And what I mean by that, I've come across leaders. In fact, I've worked for leaders who try very hard to be the person that they're not when they're leading. And I think that inauthenticity, the lack of authenticity, you know, makes them, well, exactly that, inauthentic leaders. And I'm not inspired by that.
So big thing is authentic, which means be yourself.
Yes. And, you know, even if that sometimes is a bit different, and I've always been characterized, certainly in the corporate sense, as quite a different leader. You know, I was the guy that never wore a suit or a tie and was the outlier at every board that ate through a board meeting because I can't think if I don't eat and I constantly eat. That perhaps expressed myself more freely and was more vulnerable about my own lack of knowledge or emotion. In my new role in D&I, where we talk about investments, tech and telecoms, I'm only 18 months into the role, but I'm the one who says I don't understand the most in most meetings. And I actually think, you know, that for me, in my own style that I've crafted, is a critical part of leadership. I think it flushes out a comfort in the group that, you know, if the leader leads that way and is truly happy to show their vulnerabilities and to depend as heavily as I do on my team, then we can depend on each other and we can also be vulnerable, and that's allowed. And I think that leads to a huge amount of trust and cohesion in a team.
So what happens to those people before they become leaders? Because that's when you're the most scared of saying, I don't understand, or being vulnerable. Were you like that even pre being the leader?
Yeah, I've always been consistently like that. I suppose perhaps it comes with a self-confidence that you're happy to admit when you don't understand. But, you know, talent has become for me quite easy to spot. You can spot that person who catches on quickly, fills in the gaps, asks all the questions they need to, and then uses instincts to come to conclusions. And in a leadership sense, you know, one can spot that talent, I think, coming through. And that's my definition of it. I'm quite sure you'll have other brilliant leaders who will have quite different definitions, but I suppose that's why you run the show once a week.
Absolutely. So we get some things that are, as you say, similar, and there's a theme that runs through where people are talking about being an entrepreneur, and others are always the nuance and different things, and you're sharing some of the different things with us. I just wanted to ask around your new role, the D&I, just unpack that for us. What is it, and how is your leadership in that role, as you're saying, the same as it was before, or did you have to change how you are because it's a different environment?
Radically different, and a larger and more difficult transformation than I thought it would be initially, or transition. D&I is just a fantastic story and an inspiring group, founded by my colleague, my partner, Andrew Dunn. And the business, we're an investment holding company with a very clear vision. We want to provide affordable connectivity for as many people as we can in the mass market. We seek to drive financial inclusion, and we seek to expand access to digital services and digital media. And that's what we stand for, and we've got that very clear vision. So across, we've got about 23 investments, companies where we hold primarily a control share. We support founder-led businesses. And what we're really good at is putting those founders in an ecosystem where they're deeply supported to be able to scale their businesses and integrate it into our ecosystem. So we're quite focused on telco and tech, fintech particularly, telco, tech, and we've got some media businesses. And those businesses actually all in some way relate to each other. So we've created this integrated ecosystem. And although the founders end up selling a majority stake of their businesses to us, we end up, I think, creating much more value for them through their minority share that they persist and hold as part of a much larger ecosystem and a scaled business. And I think the test is that, you know, if you ask me how many founders have left, the short answer is only one due to ill health. The rest are all still there. So a very successful model that scaled impressively.
So there's a saying that I heard years ago, it's better to have a slice of a watermelon than the whole of a grape. And that's really what you're saying, is that you've got a smaller slice, but that slice is bigger than the whole that you had before.
Yes, but let me speak against what my business actually stands for, just to make sure that there's a robust answer here. There is a debate also around diluting equity in founders who have come up with an idea, built and monetized a business, and now perhaps need capital or networks to grow their business. There are entrepreneurs and leaders who will say, geez, it's an evil thing to dilute those founders, because they should actually, when the business scales, have the largest share, not the smallest share. But, you know, my interpretation of that is that the reality to scale founder-led businesses sometimes does require a larger partner who has, one, deeper pockets from a capital point of view, but two, also broader influence. And when I look at the success of some of the founder-led businesses in D&I, particularly one that I have in mind, a business called Pay Me Now, huge success with the founder still owning a meaningful stake and, you know, deeply involved, deeply thankful that they had the opportunity to grow thanks to the support that D&I gave them. So, but there are two sides to the debate, and I want to represent that fairly, you know, in the discussion with you.
So you called it Pay Me Now. So I was going to ask you if you can reveal some of the businesses so we can get a sense. So what do they do? What is their business?
Pay Me Now, we sold out of the D&I group late last year to an offshore structure. And many of the shareholders in D&I still have a shareholding offshore, but it's now we have a management services agreement through D&I. It's an incredible business founded by four delightful entrepreneurs out of Stellenbosch. And these four guys jumped onto the bandwagon of a product called Earned Wage Access. And what Earned Wage Access does is it allows you to access a salary advance for wages that you've already earned. In other words, if you've worked a day of the month, you're eligible theoretically for 1/30th of your pay in a responsible way, a financially inclusive way, protecting people from overspending. Pay Me Now allows you to gain access to that 1/30th of your month's work on the day that you want it. And it's a necessity-driven product. There's a marketplace of goods, and actually the most common voucher bought with the payroll advance on that marketplace is actually food. And what we see in our client base, it's a very large client base now, well over 500,000 employees in South Africa are on the platform. The food vouchers that they're buying are often, many times now, sent to a third party, which is probably somebody who's a migratory worker, a common pattern in South Africa, sending food to home. There's no fees involved on our voucher, on our marketplace at all. So it's free to the employer who backs the payroll. It's free to the employee. And, they're able to gain access to funds earlier in the month. The sadness of it is, Dave, that we have a deeply indebted society. And some of that debt is extortive. And sadly, we see people with, you know, involved with loan sharks and machinises and other structures, even some NCA-approved structures, who pay crazy interest on advances. And they need the money for healthcare or for food or for transport, to sustain a family or get to work. And so we think this is a very responsible, financially inclusive practice. And we've built it around a financial wellness tool, which incentivizes people to learn about financial wellness and then gives them a bigger and bigger stake of their advance that they're eligible for as they complete the modules and courses. Sounds a bit like discovery, right?
Very much so.
But let me reassure you, it started before I got involved in D&I, so I wasn't involved in that part.
Yeah. So you mentioned it's free to the company, free to the individual. Lessons in business is you've got to make money somewhere. What's your business model with that? If it's free to the person and free to the company, how does your company make money?
Yeah, so I spoke about the marketplace, and in that marketplace of vouchers, which are completely free to the employee and the employer, we're clearly buying huge quantities of vouchers from our suppliers, largely ShopRite, Pick and Pay, Boxer, You know, Massmart, the retailers, as I said, the grocery vouchers are by far the biggest voucher. And so we've got commercial terms, payment terms, and small rebates, you know, thin margins. But because we're aggregating those and we're buying huge quantities of vouchers, that's an economically attractive and sustainable model for PayMeNow. You can also advance cash if you choose to. And on the cash advances, we charge a small administration fee and transaction fee related to a cash advance. I guess strategically, we'd love to see everybody buying vouchers for free in time. But the truth is, our taxi industry, for example, is a cash industry. We support big cleaning companies with thousands and thousands of cleaners who need to go to a building 4 o'clock in the afternoon. They clean in the evening while there's nobody there. You know, when we implemented PayMeNow at those cleaning companies, we saw absenteeism rates drop. In other words, those people were able to get the transport to get to the work to earn their money, and they get paid by shift. So we think this is a very responsible thing to offer.
So I just want to highlight that, because at the bottom of this show is really, it's an educational show. And for me, the lesson there is amazing, because we often think that you give a service and the person receiving the service pays a fee, and that's business. But you're showing that business can be a complete different model. And the model is you get it on the back end of the vouchers, which it sounds very similar to the way that Discovery operate, with incentivizing you to do the right thing, and then you get a benefit for it.
Yeah, and let me reiterate, I wasn't involved in designing that model at all. But actually, you know, Adrian Gore often speaks of shared value. And in fact, Michael Porter, the Professor Michael Porter, you know, from Porter's Theories, who's a teacher at Harvard Business School, he teaches shared value and uses the Discovery business case for it. But in the context of shared value, theoretically, everybody should come out with a dividend after the service is delivered. Everybody should benefit. And PayMeNow really does tick the boxes on shared value, in my view. It's financially deeply responsible. And actually, that's being rewarded. Some of the biggest, including the single biggest private employer in South Africa, use PayMeNow for their staff because they do see the human benefit and the economic sustainability of it.
So it sounds very much like this business is like what we see on TV of the Shark Tank or Dragon's Den, where somebody will have a business and they try to sell you the business. Is that how it is? And also, if it is along those lines, even if it's not exactly that, what are the things that you look for in a business to say, okay, this is a potential? What's a definite potential and what's definitely not?
That's an easy question to answer. It's all about the person, the jockey, the person leading the business. And, you know, let me start with your definitely not. If there's a lack of cultural alignment and a lack of comfort or belief in the founder or the leader of the business, the people behind the business, it's a non-starter for us, no matter how sexy the business looks. And I think that's an easy one. Which ones do you go for? That's much harder. You know, once you've ticked the box of the person and you're inspired by that person and you feel culturally they'll fit in our team and they'll work well with our team and our people and they have a similar value system to us, once you've got past that, then one has to understand the business fundamentals and its scalability. And we prefer businesses which are already monetized, preferably profitable, you know, linked to our core purpose, you know, that connectivity, financial inclusivity, and enriched digital experiences. It's got to be linked to that directly. We must see opportunities to integrate our other businesses in so that we can help with that ecosystem and scale. And we must see where we can add value, where we would do something that others wouldn't, that would allow that business to scale and succeed. And, you know, you look at many, many tens of businesses, you select very few, I think, for investment in the end.
Great, excellent. And I think it's a good point to stop, and we'll unpack a bit more of this, but we need to go to another ad break.
The AutJet Business Show provides mentoring, inspiration, and invaluable networking opportunities to help turn your vision into reality. Let's build your business empire together.
Welcome back. You're listening to the AutoJet Business Show. I'm David Zeidel, and we're talking to Dr. Ryan Noach, the current CEO of the D&I Group, busy unpacking how they make a decision. And before the break, Ryan was saying the first thing they look at is the person. Do they have the same value system? Do they have the same culture? And then they will invest in the potentially invest in it. Then you'll obviously go investigate the business, etc. A big portion that you take, and we spoke about it earlier, is that the businesses, you help them grow, but you take a majority stake in the business. Do you find that people push back on that? Do you find that people initially think, no, this is my baby, I've grown this thing, I don't want to just give away 50% or more of my business?
Let me just start by saying, you know, you position almost me as the decision maker. You know, we have an investment committee. The group in its current format is 8 to 9 years old. Our founder, Andrew Dunn, who built the group, he's still very involved as the chairman, and him and I work together every single day. And we have a competent team of investment professionals around us and operational leaders who are involved in the businesses. So let me just hasten to say that, you know, we have a good team of people looking at every opportunity and supporting these businesses. And we're so lucky to be working with the amazing founders that we do. You'll have to ask your question again because now it's gone.
So I just wanted to know, when you're looking at these businesses and you get pushback from the owners.
All right, I got it now.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I alluded to it earlier, and you can hear perhaps that there's an internal tension within me on that. You know, I think diluting a founder to a minority position is a double-edged sword. On the one hand, they deserve to earn, you know, the majority of the benefit from their idea and their business that they're building. And that's indisputable. But on the other hand, you know, the business may just never multiply without the capital support and the network support that, that somebody like D&I or another investment group could offer in whatever mode of investment, whether it be private equity or otherwise. And, you know, I think there is a natural tension between that. And if our approach of seeking control or seeking a pathway to control through our investment mandate, if that doesn't suit a founder, you know, we'd happily accept that and back off and hope that they can find an alternative and always be ready if they'd come back to us if they change their minds. It's not a forceful situation. We seek a marriage, which is what many of these investment partnerships are. And we're in for the long term. We're not a fund that seeks an investment with a horizon and an exit date and a massive value play, and we build up the value and then we look to get out. That's not our approach. We're long-term investors, and we want to be operationally involved in the business. My main strength is an operational leader. I'm not an investment professional. I'm learning about it fast through immersion. But, you know, we like to be involved in the businesses, innovate, come up with strategy, support the founders to do great things. And so we hands-on, we roll our sleeves up.
So somebody who you then invest in gets your brain to help them in the business. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. And a whole team of very competent people. And because we're so focused on making sure that it's in our wheelhouse, that it's linked to our vision, connectivity, financial inclusion, digital experiences. As long as it's in that wheelhouse, we've got hordes of expertise, some of the best people around to help those businesses scale. And we're the first to put up our hands and bring extra help in, you know, where we need to.
So you mentioned the term scale quite a bit, and previous people have spoken about that as well. And some of the listeners might not understand, what do you mean by scaling a business? Can you unpack that for us?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a superb question. It is, I think it's pretty easy to come up with an idea and to be an entrepreneur in the sense of, I've got a great idea. I think it gets much harder to execute on that idea. And there's a massive drop-off between the ideas and the businesses that people start with ideas and ones that actually execute and manage to form a business that is in some way profitable. I would say then there's even a bigger drop-off between those businesses and the ones that achieve massive scale. that grow to be very, very large. And one of the challenges about scaling a business is that the same old entrepreneur who started in their garage or an office with two chairs in it with that idea, if they are to lead the business to scale, they need to be able to run a massive organization thereafter. Case in point, the best example I can think of is Adrian Gore. He started the idea, there were three of them, pencil drawings and a business plan and some product ideas. Today, Adrian leads a business which globally has, probably 18, 20,000 staff, has a market cap of 150 billion and has changed the way healthcare and wellness is practiced around the world. Yet he's still the group CEO, still the leader. So as the person, he's had the ability to start with the idea, monetize it, and scale it. And that's extremely rare, extremely rare. So the person is the one limitation to scale. Capital is often a limitation, unless you've got a business which spits out cash from day one. And those are few and far between. Most of these businesses have a J-curve of some requirement. And you need deep pockets to be able to fund that J-curve through the growth cycle. And that's true for a large number of the businesses we look at. And then networks and capability. I mean, if one has to sell, whether it be on a B2B basis or a B2C basis, one has to have the networks and the understanding to do that. And I think what we do very well for these founder-led businesses that are already good businesses and already profitable and already impressive, We give them that scale. We help those CEOs develop the skills, and we support them closely to make sure that they can scale, and the examples of where they have. And we inject the capital clearly. That's our primary mandate. And at the same time, we plug them into an ecosystem and introduce the network and work hard ourselves, roll up our sleeves to sell and to create those opportunities and strategize and innovate together with them.
So I want to unpack something that you just said as if everyone understands it, and that's the J-curve, to help them up the J-curve. And for those who are not understanding it, if you think of the letter J, it goes down first and then goes up quite steeply. And the problem with a lot of businesses is they can't survive during that downturn. And so you take them through that down and then help them.
Yeah, that's it's a financial curve of cash burn. And as you can imagine, most businesses are not profitable at startup and are burning cash. And the rate at which you burn cash as you grow in that starting phase tends to accelerate till it reaches a peak, which is the bottom of the J, and then hopefully turns and starts moving and crosses the line and becomes profitable. So that's the traditional J curve.
So we're about to go for another break, but I just want to sum up because I think it's important. If you're looking to scale a business, it's about being the person who can scale, that you can change as the business changes. You mentioned also it's about having enough cash flow to do that, and that you have, or you're being connected to the different networks so that you have opportunities to grow within that. But let's unpack a little bit more around this, but after the ad break.
The AutJet Business Show provides mentoring, inspiration, and invaluable networking opportunities to help turn your vision into reality. Let's build your business empire together.
Welcome back. You're listening to the AutJet Business Show. I'm David Zeidel, and I'm talking to Dr. Ryan Noach, CEO of the D&I Group. Before the break, we were talking about scaling. But I wanted to ask you something slightly different before we unpack that just a little bit more. We had somebody previously on who was talking about investing into businesses, and he said that they look at 100 businesses and then invest in one. Is that the same as you, or are you looking at it slightly differently?
We're as selective and as picky. I would hate our team to be looking at 100 for one, simply because that's inefficient. And, we have a limited number of investment professionals that are doing that work. So we try and narrow it down firstly to is it linked to our core purpose? Is it linked to what we stand for? Secondly, is the person somebody that we can work with and that fits into our team? And thirdly, are the values aligned to our values? Is it going to do good for society? Is it going to make people's lives better? And then, you know, is it sustainable on that basis? And that clears the decks of lots of the opportunities, most of the opportunities that come your way. You know, we also want to look at businesses that are established. We like the founder-led ones. And so once you go through all these checkpoints, which are, that's a quick process, you land up with a smaller pool of opportunities.
From the person's point of view, so if you had to, if somebody's about to sell or pitch their business either to you or someone else, can you think, what are the key do's and don't do's for that person themselves?
Yeah, I think you've got to tell the story. You've got to be able to tell the story about your product quickly. In an elevator ride is the kind of cliched business pitch, but in truth, that's what you want to hear. I like when I listen to the story about a business to understand what that business is doing on the first slide and in the first sentence. This is what we do. This is what we stand for. And this is how we'll meet customers' demands. And there's a need out there that we're satisfying. This is what it is. I find sometimes the pitch, you still don't get it until somewhere in the middle of a pitch or near the end about what is actually going to happen here. Because there's lots of bump about we've done this analysis and we've done this market research and we've seen this and we've seen that. And you still don't understand, you know, what it stands for. And you know, Gerry Fourie is the CEO and leader of Capitec, and he's retiring on the 18th of July. Today is the 3rd, so 15 days' time. Fortunately, staying on for a year at least. But, you know, he speaks about simplicity. And the success of Capitec, which, by the way, I'm sure you know, was voted the best bank in the world at one point in the recent past. It's a Capitec success, sweeping the market, you know, sliding between the legs of giant banks. And when they turned around, you know, their lunch had been stolen. He just simplified banking and the banking proposition so that the mass market in South Africa got it and understood it. And he knew that the key issue there was also affordability. And, you know, if you speak to Gerry, which I've been fortunate to do, or you read the stuff he's written, simplicity, he tests every single business proposition around simplicity. My view on a product, a brilliant product, is one that there's enough complexity to be differentiated and a moat for your customers, but so much simplicity that it's easy to execute and your customers understand it immediately. And I think you need that natural tension between complexity and simplicity. The complexity should be hidden away, and the simplicity should be completely apparent.
So that's fantastic. I've got one last question for you around... You mentioned, like, you will sift out all the different things so that you're looking only at the core business. So when I'm running my business, I'm keep thinking I don't have enough customers. If I had to sift out my customers, I'd have a problem. How do you generate all these leads so that you can look at the businesses?
Yeah, I think you need to be plugged in. Now, you know, D&I, I'm fortunate. Andrew's done such a brilliant job of D&I. That we've got a great reputation, and if somebody's in the telco or fintech space, they probably know about us, and they'll probably come and knock on our door. You know, we were the number one distributor of mobile SIMs, of mobile products in South Africa in the last year for all four networks, Vodacom, MTN, Cell C, and Telkom. We were number one across the board. So we have scale and we have a reputation as being a leading business. So we've reached the fortunate point that they come to us. You need plugged in professionals, and our team is truly plugged in to our industry and to investing. And, you know, our investment professionals, particularly our chief strategy officer, who's an ex-investment banker trained at RMB, you know, he is known to the industry as an investment professional of standing. So I think it's the people, the brand, the credibility. And don't forget, we don't lose the founders. The people we look after have all done well. The rest of it is history. The rest of their story is history. So I suppose it smells really good for somebody coming in.
So you're basically creating the future history, which is amazing. So if I unpack some of the things that you mentioned, you said You've got to enjoy what you're doing. You've got to have fun. And then you live by your purpose. And your quote, which I love, is the more you do, the more you get. And you've got to be unique. And you need to be, when you say your purpose, you've got to be authentic. You're not making up that purpose. You've got to have a great work rate. So you've got to work initially even faster so that you can get that through. You try get the right people on. And be deeply, deeply hungry. Be a force for good. Be different. So show how you're different, but be able to do it simply. And that whole share valued. And when you want to scale, it's about being the person who can change. It's around getting the cash flow enough and plugging into the networks. I think these are all unbelievable lessons. I think whoever's listening has been through a mini MBA tonight. So Ryan, I just want to thank you so much for being with us. I'm David Zeidel. This has been the AutJet Business Show, and we've been listening to Dr. Ryan Noach.